Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Have you ever wanted to speak another language? Whether you want to speak Spanish, French, or German, Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons can get you speaking confidently in your new language within weeks. Babbel's spaced repetition method gradually builds your language skills so you intuitively remember what you've learned. No wonder Babbel is the number one selling language learning app in the world. Try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com or download the app. That's Babbel, B-A-B-B-E-L.com, or download the Babbel app to try for free.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janat Jalil, and in the early hours of Friday, the 23rd of August, these are our main stories. The United Nations Security Council meets to discuss the new US cruise missile program. The UN Secretary General has said he's deeply concerned by the growing number of wildfires in the Brazilian Amazon. France has told Britain that there can be no major changes to the Brexit agreement, but some minor alterations may still be possible. Also in this podcast, why the American singer Taylor Swift might be re-recording her old songs. We begin at the United Nations in New York, where the Security Council has been considering a joint Russian and Chinese request to discuss the threat they say is posed by US medium-range missiles. This follows an announcement by the Pentagon on Monday that the US had tested a ground-launched cruise missile that hit its target after travelling 500 kilometres. And this comes weeks after the US pulled out of the decades-old Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia that banned such missiles. Addressing the council, the US ambassador, Jonathan Cohen, explained why the United States had felt obliged to withdraw from the INF treaty.
We're here today because the Russian Federation preferred a world in which the United States continued to fulfill its INF treaty obligations, while the Russian Federation did not. Indeed, the Russian Federation and China would still like a world where the United States exercises self-restraint while they continue their arms buildups, unabated and unabashed.
I asked our defence and diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus, what we should make of the Russian and Chinese complaints about arms violations.
One has to be a little cynical because, after all, Russia, on the one hand, is the reason the Americans withdrew from the treaty. America insisted that Russia has already itself broken the treaty, deployed weapons that were banned by it, and finally America lost its patience and said, well, if you're not going to abide by the treaty, we won't either. As far as China is concerned, it was never part of the agreement. It's got a very large arsenal of this category of weapons. And indeed, the Americans are now saying they want to develop equivalent weapons, largely, I think, because of the concerns about the threat in Asia from China, not really much interest in what the Russians may be up to.
And there has been a lot of concern about the collapse of this treaty, which had been in place for three decades. Are we looking at a new arms race?
Well, that's the real danger. So it's clear that both sides, all sides, are continuing with the development of new weapons. It should be said that the particular weapon tested by the Americans is designed to have a conventional warhead, not a nuclear one. But the problem, of course, is that with all sides now pushing ahead with development, it's a moot point whether the Americans will actually get the money from Congress to actually pursue this program rapidly. But nonetheless, you know, this isn't the only nuclear treaty or arms control treaty that is falling by the wayside. And that's the real fear at a time of growing superpower, growing tensions, growing competition. The treaties that used to regulate and control this competition are now disappearing one by one.
Jonathan Marcus. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has said he's deeply concerned about a record number of wildfires in Brazil's Amazon region. Mr. Guterres said that the rainforest is a major source of oxygen and diversity and must be protected. Official figures show an increase of more than 80% this year in fires across Brazil, most of them in the Amazon region. Environmental groups have accused President Jair Bolsonaro of encouraging farming and logging in the rainforest. So great is the outrage at the increased deforestation that Brazil's environment minister, Ricardo Salles, was heckled at a meeting on climate change.
Mr. Ricardo Salles, Minister, you have the floor.
Divino Silvario works for the Amazon Environmental Research Institute in the state of Mato Grosso, which is 40% rainforest.
We have a dense smoke on the sky. We have many fires occurring around. And we have, looking at this data, trying to relate that to dry season length and also with the deforestation area. And we have a surprise to see that most of these fires is more concentrating in the areas that were recently deforested.
The city of Sao Paulo, a four-hour flight and nearly 3,000 kilometres from the Amazon, has been affected by smoke caused by the fires. Our correspondent in the city, Daniel Gallas, told me more.
There were 74,000 fires, not just in the Amazon, also in all forests in Brazil, but mainly in the Amazon. That was an 80% increase comparing to last year. So a lot of people got alarmed. There are spikes every now and then in a few years because of dry season. But we know that all fires are caused by human activity, ultimately. So there isn't really an analysis of what made these fires happen, why there is this surge in wildfires in Brazil. But a lot of people suspecting that there is more deforestation because some satellite images suggest that, and there was an increase in deforestation. And also because there's a sense that a lot of people who do illegal deforestation are feeling empowered by this government because it hasn't been tackling deforestation and the exploration of the Amazon.
And these fires are so bad that the smoke is spreading a long, long distance, and it's reached all the way to Sao Paulo, for instance, where you are, thousands of kilometers away from the Amazon rainforest.
Yes, it's quite common for this to happen in cities like Manaus or in states like Roraima, in the middle of the Amazon, and people have been living with this for decades. But no one remembers this ever reaching a place like Sao Paulo, which is Latin America's largest city, and a lot of the population live here.
A lot of people pointing the finger at President Jair Bolsonaro, saying that this massive increase in the number of fires in the Amazon has coincided with him coming to power.
Yes, it's happening also during Brazil's dry season when there is an increase in fires. But the surge, this 80% surge, and like I mentioned, there was also an 80% surge in deforestation in June and a 280% deforestation surge in July comparing to 2018. So there are a lot of people pointing the fingers to Jair Bolsonaro and saying that he is responsible for all of this. Like I said, there isn't really an analysis of what is happening on the ground. The response from the government has been quite strange, because President Bolsonaro suggested that international NGOs could be the ones setting fire to the Amazon just to provoke these numbers and to cause this surge, which is something that not only the NGOs themselves contest, but also the scientific community in Brazil and abroad.
Daniel Gallas in Sao Paulo. The French President Emmanuel Macron has said it's too late to fully renegotiate the terms of Britain's departure from the European Union. But he told the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson that some tweaks to the deal could still be reached. Speaking in Paris alongside the French President, Mr. Johnson said Britain wanted an agreement and would not be the one to reinstate a hard border in Ireland. From the French capital, our political correspondent Ben Wright reports.
In the sun-baked central courtyard of the Élysée Palace, President Macron and Boris Johnson spoke warmly about the Anglo-French relationship. But Brexit is putting it under significant strain. The Prime Minister arrived for talks with Mr. Macron, seemingly buoyed by the German Chancellor Angela Merkel's willingness to talk yesterday about possible solutions to the Irish border issue. Boris Johnson said he was powerfully encouraged by his discussions in Germany and said he was confident a deal could be reached. The huge sticking point is the Irish backstop, the mechanism intended to prevent a hard border on the island of Ireland, whatever the future trade arrangements between Britain and the EU. Boris Johnson says it would trap the UK into the EU's customs rules and must be removed from the withdrawal agreement altogether. Today he tried to reassure the French president there was no need for the backstop.
I understand your desire to protect the integrity of the single market. Of course we understand that. But we think that there are ways of protecting the integrity of the single market and allowing the UK to exit from the EU whole and entire and perfect, as it were.
But the EU says the backstop is the only way to ensure an open Irish border when Britain leaves the single market and customs union, which is what Boris Johnson wants to happen. It is so far unpersuaded by any of the alternative ideas Britain has put forward. And today President Macron insisted that the backstop was essential to the existing Brexit deal.
The key elements of this agreement, including the Irish backstop, are not just technical constraints or quibbling, but indeed indispensable guarantees to preserve the stability in Ireland and the integrity of the single market, which are fully part of the agreement negotiated over a long period of time between the UK and the EU.
However, President Macron did not point blank refuse to renegotiate the Brexit deal. In fact, he said a solution could be reached without reshuffling the current agreement. Boris Johnson will have further talks with EU leaders at the G7 summit in Biarritz at the weekend. His visits to Berlin and Paris have certainly shown a willingness by European leaders to give Boris Johnson a hearing, but it's hard to see who will make a compromise that could break this stalemate.
Ben Wright in Paris. A Russian judge has ruled that the opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, can be released on Friday despite a police request that he serve more time in prison to compensate for a stay in hospital. Mr. Navalny had argued in court that he'd been under guard at all times while in medical care and that he'd only been moved to hospital because he believed he'd been poisoned. From Moscow, Sarah Rainsford reports.
This is a rare court decision in favour of Alexei Navalny. The judge decided there was no need to extend his custody by 18 hours, the time the opposition activist spent in hospital last month. The request had come from police, but in court, Mr. Navalny argued he'd been under guard at all times in hospital. He also reminded the judge he was only there after he believes he was poisoned. Doctors diagnosed Mr. Navalny's sudden illness at the time as an allergic reaction. What caused that remains a mystery. He should now, in theory, be released after 30 days in a police detention centre. But other opposition figures here have found themselves detained again immediately on the doorstep. It seems the authorities want to keep key opposition figures safely out of sight and action, ahead of a local election that sparked Russia's biggest street protests in years. They began when independent candidates were barred from running for Moscow City Parliament, and they grew after protesters were beaten by police and a dozen people, including students, were charged with rioting.
Sarah Rainsford. Staying with Russia, and a life-size humanoid robot is making its way to the International Space Station after blasting off on a two-week mission to support the crew and test its skills. Named Fedor, or Skybot F-850, the robot is the first of its type to be sent into space by Russia. The American space agency NASA sent Robonaut 2 to space in 2011. In the long term, it's hoped such robots will carry out complex tasks such as spacewalks. A Russian space journalist, Dmitry Oliferovich, told my colleague, James Menendez, more about the Russian robot Fedor. You'll hear him using the term EVA, which stands for extravehicular activity or spacewalks.
This robot is essentially what they call an avatar robot. It needs a remote human operator to control its movements, and it's supposed to be able to do a wide range of tasks, from uncapping a water bottle to using a screwdriver or any other tools that the crew might need the robot to use on the station. And its actual purpose is to assist humans on the station and outside the station and in the future on deep space missions, performing tasks in hazardous environments. Roscosmos has reported that the robot has autonomous capacity, so it has some kind of artificial intellect as well. But they're going to test it primarily with using the human operator.
Yes, and it's a version of a robot that Russia's been developing for a few years, I understand it. But this one's been adapted for spaceflight because that, of course, has its own rigors, doesn't it?
It certainly does. This robot essentially has to withstand the rigors of the launch, the G overloads, working in micro-G environments, etc. And in the future, it should be able to work on the surface of the moon and other planetary bodies where the rigors of deep space add additional constraints.
And is the hope that one day a robot might be able to do something like a space walk, which is obviously dangerous for humans?
There definitely are such hopes. This robot, just to make it clear, Skybot F-150 is called, will not be doing any spacewalks this time around. In fact, it will be on a very short mission there, just a couple of weeks. But in the future, such robots might be able to do EVAs, because EVAs are perhaps the most dangerous part of low Earth orbit missions. And if we can just keep people out of those hazardous environments and instead send out robots to do some maintenance tasks to place and remove samples, why not?
And how significant is it that Russia is managing to send a robot into space? Because I think it's the only, well, it's the only thing on board, isn't it? I mean, is Russia behind the United States, for example, in this sort of technology?
I don't think we're actually behind. There's only a few nations that have actually sent up their robot designs to the station thus far. Actually, I would say that the Russian design is even a bit ahead of the other nations' designs in that it's a big human-sized robot that has the physical capacity to perform various tasks. So it's only a test project, of course, but it's definitely an important first for Russia's space program, and it will definitely pave way for more designs if this one goes well.
The Russian space journalist Dmitry Oliferovich. Now, here's news of another podcast from the BBC World Service. In the Outlook podcast, we meet ordinary people who have extraordinary stories, like the Holocaust survivor who bought a drum kit and started a band at the age of 89, or the woman who had a baby and started believing she was the Hollywood actress Cameron Diaz. Those and hundreds of other stories are waiting for you now in the Outlook feed. Just search for Outlook wherever you get your podcasts. Now to Syria, where the government says it's opened a humanitarian corridor to allow civilians to flee from part of the rebel-held province of Idlib, which has been the scene of intense fighting in recent months, in which hundreds of civilians have been killed. Russian-backed government forces have been advancing in southern Idlib. Alan Johnston reports.
It's understood the humanitarian corridor would allow civilians to escape, but people in opposition-held territory are often wary of crossing into government-controlled areas. They fear they may be arrested or conscripted into the army. Set against this, life for civilians in Idlib is extremely dangerous. Hundreds have been killed in airstrikes on rebel-held towns, and hundreds of thousands have been forced to flee their homes, taking what refuge they can find further north, nearer the Turkish border.
Alan Johnston. Now to Bangladesh and the border with Myanmar. That's where hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims have been living in temporary camps for the past 2 years. They were forced to flee Myanmar following operations by the army against their villages in Rakhine State. On Thursday, there was an attempt to start repatriating some of the Rohingya families back to Myanmar. Buses were laid on by the Bangladeshi authorities, but not a single person boarded the 5 buses and 10 lorries. My colleague James Menendez spoke to Athena Rayburn from the charity Save the Children. She's based in Cox's Bazar, the city closest to the camps.
From what we understand, no Rohingya have elected to return to Myanmar at this stage. The government of Bangladesh has confirmed that there will be no Rohingya returning on the buses to Myanmar.
Why are people so afraid?
They're afraid because they are concerned that the conditions that they fled from 2 years ago are still the same. When the Rohingya fled into Cox's Bazar, many of them had witnessed and experienced grave violations and human rights abuses, had witnessed their villages being burned down, they had seen family members murdered, and for many years before that, didn't have access to basic rights. They want to return home, but not until they have access to those and know that they'll be safe.
Is it true that the last time this was tried, I think it was at the end of last year, that people were so afraid that they ran away from the camps?
There's a lot of fear around repatriation in the camps. And yes, last time it was very difficult. And even now when we speak to refugees ahead of this repatriation, they tell us that they are scared, that they are fearful. However, the government of Bangladesh and UNHCR, bearing in mind the events of last November, have made a concerted effort this time to make sure that the Rohingya know that no one will be forced to return to Myanmar.
Is it also true that UNHCR are unable to visit Rakhine State in Myanmar and see what the conditions are like ahead of a potential return?
Yes, there are areas in northern Rakhine where there is currently no humanitarian access. We have been calling on UNHCR, have been requesting access in order to assess conditions and make sure that residents in that area have access to aid.
Athena Rayburn from the Save the Children charity in Cox's Bazar. In some parts of Africa, the social stigma of menstruation and the cost of sanitary products is having a huge impact on young lives. It's estimated that 1 in 10 girls on the continent miss school when they have their period. The difficulty of accessing tampons and sanitary pads, often called period poverty, means that some girls are resorting to contraceptive injections to control them. From Namibia, the BBC's Rhoda Odhiambo reports.
The average cost of a pack of sanitary towels in Namibia is between $1 and $3, enough to buy 2 loaves of bread or a 700 milliliter bottle of cooking oil. For most, it's a luxurious commodity. It's estimated that more than 150,000 girls in Namibia can't afford to buy sanitary products. One of them is Namasiku, who had her first period when she was 12 years old.
Thought I was having a sore, or maybe I'm wounded. Yes.
When you told your mom, what did your mom say?
Her mom told me that you are now grown up and you have to take care of yourself.
Every 28 days, Namasiku uses anything to conceal her monthly cycle.
After she told you that you're grown, was she able to buy for you sanitary towels?
No, she was not able to buy sanitary pads. She only told me that I must use, cut a piece of mattress and use until she gets the sanitary pads.
Contraceptives are freely available in all government hospitals to girls who are sexually active. Those below the age of 16 must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. Namasiku's mother, Anita, once took her to a clinic to be given the injection to control her menstrual flow.
I encouraged my daughter to use a family planning method. I used to go with her, but now she's being helped. She gets pads from school and is no longer using the contraceptive.
In another part of the city, I meet 17-year-old Ndapewa. She's been on the hormonal injection for a year because she can't afford sanitary towels, but she's anxious about taking it.
For me, I'll go on my periods for 3 times in a year only. There's no way a person can go on periods for 3 months in a year. It's totally not fine.
Diminished periods are a normal side effect of the injection. Fertility is usually fully re-established for most women within 10 months from having their last injection. It comes with warnings that it doesn't protect against sexually transmitted infections and can be associated with significant bone mineral density loss. Gynecologist John K. Saab says that even though the benefits of the injection outweigh the risks, it should not solely be used for controlling menstrual flow.
When somebody comes to a clinician, whether it's at the clinic or to a doctor, and says, can I get contraception so that I don't menstruate, so to say, I think we've got to educate them at that point. That's not the initial intended reason.
Lobby groups in the country are calling on the government to exempt sanitary towels from taxation, as well as distribute them or provide more sustainable alternatives like menstrual cups to those in need. Some experts, like Professor Atiya Waris, say they should take it one step further.
You can get drugs for free. Tuberculosis drugs are for free. So why is it that sanitary pads, which are a necessity, are not?
Professor Atiya Waris, ending that report by Rhoda Odhiambo from Namibia. The Duke of Cambridge, Prince William, and his wife Kate have been seen getting off a budget flight to Scotland amid a continuing row about his brother Prince Harry's use of private jets this summer with his family. Prince William and Kate are thought to be visiting the Queen in her summer residence, Balmoral. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex have taken 4 trips in private jets in 11 days, including a flight to Nice provided by the singer Elton John. Here's our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
It's an experience many will be familiar with. Too much luggage, a cluster of children, one in mum's arms, another tugging at dad's already overburdened hand. It's the very banality of the moment, the end of a budget flight from Norwich to Aberdeen, that is striking. after a week of pretty hellish headlines for the royal family, with Harry and Meghan again in the firing line for their use of a private jet, and with celebrities jumping to their defence, William and Kate could not be travelling in simpler style. Some might suspect a public relations stunt, but it's not that uncommon for the Sussexes or the Cambridges. Harry and Meghan have flown budget and commercial airlines, and it's far from William and Kate's first time. It is some good publicity for the royal family, in amongst headlines about scandal and hypocrisy.
Johnny Diamond. The American singer Taylor Swift has suggested that she might re-record her old songs in order to regain control over her back catalogue. The star's first six albums are now owned by the music mogul Scooter Braun, who bought her former record company in June. At the time, she said she'd been stripped of her life's work and accused Scooter Braun of manipulative bullying. Our entertainment correspondent Lisa Mazimbo has more details.
Over the past 15 years, Taylor Swift has sold tens of millions of records. But like many musicians, the master tapes for many of her biggest hits, like Shake It Off, don't belong to her. Whoever does own them, usually the record company, generally has the publishing rights for an artist's music and will earn a large proportion of the money from it being downloaded or streamed. Taylor Swift's masters were recently bought by the music manager Scooter Braun, someone Swift has accused of bullying her earlier in her career. The singer still has some of the composition rights for writing the songs and has said that she's going to re-record her first five albums and will retain ownership of those recordings. Taylor Swift says that she'll start recording the new versions of her old music in 2020, but that won't stop Scooter Braun from making money every time someone buys or streams one of her original recordings.
Lisa Mazimbo reporting there. Now, an unusual job advertisement. A heritage railway in Dorset in southern England says it's in danger of running out of steam because it desperately needs new and younger volunteers to replace those who are on the brink of retirement. The Swanage Railway is hoping to recruit 40 drivers over the next 5 years. Applicants have to have good eyesight and are required to start as a locomotive cleaner. Bernardo has been finding out more.
Half a century ago, it was every schoolboy's dream to be a train driver. But times have changed, and while around 13 million people a year visit one of the UK's 75-odd working steam railways, the attractions themselves are running out of drivers. The Battle of Britain-class locomotive 257 Squadron gets up steam at the Swanage Railway in Dorset. The line runs just over 9 miles between Wareham, Corfe Castle and Swanage. It takes several hours to build the fire in a locomotive. It's hot, hard work. The Swanage Railway has 42 volunteer drivers, but the majority are over 60. They need to recruit 7 a year. And that's not easy, even though the railway's David Rawsthorne says driving a steam train is well worth the effort.
Loads of people will come up to you and ask you questions as to what it's like firing or driving a steam locomotive and what you get out of it. And nearly all our volunteers tell us they get a huge buzz, a real sense of satisfaction of being part of living history, of doing something that makes somebody else's day.
But it's not just a shortage of drivers that's causing concern. Many of the steam engines are approaching 100 years of age and need skilled engineers who understand their quirks. And there are shortages too of guards and platform staff. With visitor numbers booming, attracting young visitors to the trains of yesteryear is easy. But finding volunteers to keep them running in years to come is not.
That report was by Bernardo in southern England. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.